Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. Greetings. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for joining us tonight. What's shaking out there? Big storm battering parts of the West Coast tonight. California could certainly use the rain, given the Golden State is in the throes of its worst drought in a century. But the danger is the rainstorms turned into floods and mudslides in areas that were scorched and laid barren by the summer wildfires, making a bad situation even worse. Hope everyone in the West is safe inside tonight, and I sure hope some of that rain makes it down this way. Tonight, cool stuff from two intrepid writers and researchers. You know, one of the persistent and convenient excuses and faux explanations for UFO, UAP cases has always been secret technology. It's ours. It's the Russians. It's the Chinese. You know, all those strange craft that engulfed 10 different Navy warships off the West Coast in the summer of 2019, for instance. Oh, yeah, those were just Chinese drones, you know, hundreds of them launched from who knows where, returned to who knows where, shaped like nothing aerodynamic that we know of, with no wings, no props, no propellers, no known propulsion, no contrails, no indication of burning fuel. Oh, and some of them dipped into the ocean. So they're transmedium, in effect. Must be the Chinese, right? That sort of reasoning has long been used by debunkers to explain away UFO cases. In fact, it goes way back to World War II, when oddly shaped aerial objects buzzed American and British bombers and fighters. We thought they must be German secret weapons. The Germans thought they were seeing them, too, and assumed they were ours. The Russians saw them. Foo Fighters was the nickname that eventually stuck. Foo Fighters also happens to be, of course, the name of a great rock band, agreed? German secret wonder weapons developed near the end of the war, some asked. So how did they end up being seen in the Pacific theater then after the Germans were conquered? The Japanese didn't build them either. The Foo Fighter mystery goes to the heart of the modern UFO era and is as pertinent today as it was 75, 80 years ago. As we grapple with some of the same kind of sweeping, dismissive debunking efforts that were around back then, a new, highly detailed, deeply researched examination of the Foo Fighter saga has been compiled by Graham Rendall in his book UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters 1940 to 45. It's a highly entertaining read that also digs down into these tales about Nazi flying saucers, whether the U.S. or the Russians scooped up the scientists and that technology at the end of the war. We start that conversation minutes from now. Then in the second half, a look at more current UFO cases and investigations with Richard Lang. Richard is a seasoned investigator, part of a special team created within MUFON, a team that worked directly with what was, until recently, a secret program managed by the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. That program had the nickname OSAP. It was a bigger, better-funded precursor to ATIP. Sorry for all the acronyms, but that was the program headed by Lou Elizondo, as reported by the New York Times back in December 2017. Richard was my guest earlier this year to help share some of his investigative techniques and secrets, and he returns tonight to address some specific cases and incidents, challenges in what he calls the age of disclosure. He's here in the second half. Not sure if you saw this news item this late last week. It came out a couple of days ago, but it looks like the still secret documents related to the JFK assassination will remain secret at least a bit longer. So what's in those documents? How in the world could they still be considered a legitimate threat to national security if they were made public? It seems kind of fishy to me. Journalist Brian Bender of Politico put together an assessment today of why those documents are still being withheld, what might be in those papers. It's one of the stories we pulled together for Knapp's News. That's the name of the little compendium of items and oddities culled from the world's news media by webmaster Lex Lonehood and me, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the other stories there tonight, archaeologists have found what they believe to be the world's oldest drawing of a ghost. It's contained on a Babylonian exorcism tablet. I didn't know there was such a thing, but check it out. It's really interesting. Also, two stories about shapeshifters. One is by our colleague Nick Redfern, who often delves into really strange and esoteric matters. The second is from a zoological perspective. It looks at real-life animal species who are in the process of shape-shifting in response to severe climate change, essentially evolving right before our eyes in an attempt to survive. Those stories and more in Naps News tonight. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is 15 cents a day. If you subscribe for a year, gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. It's a great deal. Also there, info on how to subscribe to Beyond Belief. That's George Norrie's television program, which includes compelling interviews with interesting guests on topics and subjects similar to what George does here on the radio. Take a look at that option. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the rooster and the goat. Put on a pot of Joe, the good stuff. Slide your bod into those fall jammies and your toes into the Halloween-themed slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio. In a moment, Graham Randall and the Foo Fighter Mystery. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Graham Randall is a contributor to The Debrief. It's an American news website dealing with cutting-edge science, tech, and defense news. We often post articles here. He's also a frequent guest on various podcasts looking at UAP phenomena. He writes articles on the UAP subject for a number of outlets. Between 1990 and 92, he was the editor of an amateur aviation magazine. He's been an aviation and World War II history enthusiast from an early age when he was given airfix kits to, quote, keep him quiet. Married to Joe, he lives in rural Northumberland in the UK, where it is very early in the morning. Graham, great to meet you, even if it's through a phone line, and glad to welcome you to Coast for the first time.
George, it's great to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Absolutely. You know, I really wanted to read your book because while Foo Fighters get mentioned here and there in UFO programs and documentaries, it's usually a very fleeting kind of manner, a few sentences kind of gloss it over, and then there's wild stories floated, which it turns out don't have much heft behind them to explain it all away. I think this is such a deep and intensive dive, your book, into this topic, digs up way more accurate information than I ever knew existed. I mean, you scoured all kinds of files, came up with documents, old newspaper articles. It's really some great research.
Yeah, I think the Foo Fighters have been the Cinderella of ufology for many years. In recent years, it's had a little bit of a resurgence, but for the first 50 years following the end of the war, it was only a very limited number of reports that were in the public realm. So naturally, there wasn't much emphasis put on that particular part of ufology. People moved on to much more sexy things, such as the current events, you know, after Roswell into the 50s and 60s. The attention was drawn by those cases, and nobody really gave any sort of, you know, importance to the things that were happening in the war. But that was because of these limited number of reports. Now, that was going to be natural. These UFO authors, just as you said, just glossed over the subject. And if you were lucky, when I used to read books in the 70s and 80s, I would be lucky if I saw, you know, five lines, a paragraph or two, and there was very limited information to go on.
This project started out as a writing assignment for The Debrief, right? It seems like you took that assignment to heart and ran with it.
No, it actually started earlier than that, George. I started the book just around Christmas, but in April this year, or just before April this year, I was speaking to MJ Benias about another writing assignment for The Debrief. And I just mentioned that I was coming up with a book, possibly about the Foo Fighters. And he said, oh, would you like to do an article just to see, you know, the parallels between the 2004 case, the Nimitz encounters, and some of the cases in 2015, 2016, the ones we all know and love with the U.S. Navy, and some of the encounters that I was looking into from 1943. And that's where the basis of that particular article came. And it was just showing that there were parallels in terms of the so-called dogfights between the U.S. Navy aircraft in 2004 and the Tic Tac, but also similar kind of things had happened in 1943. So, you know, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I mean, this is no dry historical treatise, you know. It's very entertaining. You really make this come alive. And by the time I finished the book, it was clear to me also why it was still so relevant. No one ever managed to solve the Foo Fighter mystery. Lots of weak excuses and explanations were offered, but along with a lot of social pressure back then. People who reported them were accused of being drunks. Air crews didn't report anything because they were worried how they'd be viewed by their colleagues. a lot of derision and disincentives to not report anything. The higher ups tried to dismiss it all. Many of the same things we see today, the assumption that it's got to be secret tech. You know, it was secret tech back then, just as the Tic Tac supposedly is now. It was the Nazis, the Russians, the Japanese, maybe it was the Americans and Brits. Our side thought it was Germans. The Germans thought that they were ours. Both were wrong. I mean, do you agree that the lessons from the Foo Fighter era are something we need to keep in mind now, given there are so many similarities?
Exactly. It's a microcosm of what's happening, you know, through the 50s, 60s, and even up to today. The stigma was there then. That was an early, you know, sort of manifestation of people ridiculing other people who had seen things they couldn't understand. And it got to the point where just crews kept quiet because they weren't going to put themselves through either the kind of stick that they got from their squadron mates or the potential to be grounded because they might be considered to be mad or unfit to fly. But also, it was just the inability of senior officials to get their head around what was going on. They were given information, but they didn't know what to do with it because everything that was being seen in the sky was treated as a German secret weapon, because what else would it be? There was no such thing as flying saucers or UFOs in the lexicon back then. So therefore, they had no frame of reference. Anything that was strange was going to be a German secret weapon. So therefore, everything in the intelligence documents leads up to that kind of analysis. That they just don't have any kind of understanding about, you know, the possibility of anything else.
Somewhere in the book, I can't remember where it is, but there's a quote, I think maybe you wrote it, that there's a period of where there was a real dearth of UFO cases. Of course, as you mentioned, we didn't call them flying saucers or UFOs from the mid-20s on to the start of the war. Is that in fact true, or that there were just no cases, or that's nothing that we would be able to identify because we didn't use the same terminology back then?
I think that there were cases, certainly. I mean, if you go back to, let's say, the 1890s, and you've got the mystery airship cases, and they go on into the 1910s and through the First World War. But then in the 1920s and 1930s, you get these what they called ghost aircraft sightings. And these were, well, they weren't entirely aircraft. Nobody's really sure what they were. They looked like aircraft to witnesses. They flew like aircraft, but they also flew in conditions where no self-respecting pilot would fly. So they flew in snowstorms and fog, and it was just really strange. So you do have quite a lot of sightings of those in the 20s and 30s. And I can remember John Keel reporting on those in books that he wrote back in the 1970s. But the actual dearth of the reports that you mentioned, and certainly leading up to the mid-1990s, was in the war. That's where you just had a gap in terms of the reporting. So most UFO books that I read when I was a child or when I was in my 20s basically got up to the Second World War and then stopped, and then there was just a gap. And then you started again with the ghost rockets of 1946 in Scandinavia and Kenneth Arnold and Roswell in 1947. So, you know, that gap, to me, needed to be filled, and I wasn't sure how, back then, you know, where these reports were. All there was just these half dozen reports that actually appeared in a December 1945 edition of a magazine called American Legion, which had been written by an aide to General Hap Arnold, who was the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Army Air Force during World War II. And he'd managed to get a hold of an intelligence document which had about 14 cases in it. And it had been supplied by the 415th Night Fighter Squadron to their senior commanders to try and see what was, you know, what this kind of the Foo Fighter menace was all about. And the magazine writer had actually got these cases from that. He'd added a couple of cases from the Pacific, and he'd made this article up. But for 50 years, pretty much, that they were the only cases that anybody knew about from the war.
Give me a couple of broad strokes, big issues, and then we'll dive down into some specifics. So, you know, okay. World War II breaks out. The whole world is fighting. It seems to make sense that with the world at war, it would attract attention from, if there is a non-human intelligence involved, and they've been monitoring Earth, whether from other planets or other realities or whatever it is, that a big war like that would definitely attract attention, that they want to get up close and personal and see what the heck was going on.
I mean, that's true. But also you could look at it from a slightly different direction in connection with that. You've got lots of people in the sky at once. So you have tens of thousands of people flying around in the day, but also now at night, because night operations were something new. In the First World War, there are reports of mystery aircraft and mystery tic-tac-shaped objects, for want of a better expression. However, when you get to World War II, night operations start in earnest in a big way. So you have fleets of aircraft flying over not only Britain, but over Germany and other parts of the world at night. So they're bound to start seeing things which are anomalous. So you've got two important things there. You've got, as you say, you've got a world conflict, which the First World War was a world conflict, but it wasn't as much around the world as the Second World War was. And then also you've got this night element where there's a lot of people in the dark seeing things that they can't understand.
And people on the ground looking up, wondering when the bombs are going to fall on them, too. They end up seeing things that you document.
On anti-aircraft duty, people manning searchlights, just generally people out and about all over the globe and looking at the skies in case they're going to come under air attack. So, yes, you're right. There's a lot of people watching the skies, a lot of people in the skies. But then also you've got radar. So they have, you know, sensors now, just the rudimentary elements of air defense networks, being able to probe the skies electronically and see whether they pick up things. So there's different dimensions here, which changes the kind of, you know, the ball game in terms of being able to not only see but also report strange objects in the skies.
The general public's knowledge of Foo Fighters, I mean, we'll get into the name and where it came from, but just balls of light. That's the general impression that people have, is that these are balls of light. But as you document in this book, there was a heck of a lot of different kinds of Foo Fighters that were reported. Different shapes, sizes, different colors, right?
Yeah, definitely. The Foo Fighter name, as you say, we'll get into that. But that was a limited kind of phenomenon in terms of when it was coined and where it applied to. So you're looking at about the last 6 months of the war. But as you say, the actual phenomenon as a whole encompassed a whole load of different shapes, sizes, and colors. Not just lights, but objects, craft even. So you're looking at things from 200-foot-long torpedo-shaped objects with pairs of red lights along them to what they're called upturned bathtubs and everything in between. So everything that you've seen afterwards, the things that were reported in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and right up to date, were seen during the war, just at different times, different places. So it is a microcosm of everything that happened afterwards.
Well, let's start with, let's go into the name, Foo Fighters. There are a couple of different stories, and you dive into them. I had always heard the thing that it came from the comic strip, but you have that version and another version, so share that with us.
Yeah, so another guy from the same squadron that said that he'd come up with the story, but really there's not much credence given to that particular story, so it's not entirely worth bothering with. The main story, and the one that is actually generally accepted, is a chap called Donald Myers, and he was a radar observer. So he was the guy in the back of the aircraft who was hunched over a small airborne radar set, looking at something that looked like an oscilloscope display, trying to work out, where the enemy aircraft were. He'd been a part of a crew, and they'd been chased by one of these red lights over the skies, the skies of Belgium, Eastern France, if I get pardon. And they'd been frightened by this light that was falling, and they couldn't get it off their tail. And then when they got back to base, they'd obviously been debriefed by the intelligence officer at the base, a guy called Captain Fred Wingwald. And he sort of, took on board what they were saying, but he didn't really believe them. So he said, what is this thing you're seeing? And Myers got a hold of a comic that was in the back pocket of his flight overalls. And it happened to have the comic strip in that we were talking about. And he slammed it down on the intelligence officer's desk and said, "There's your effing Foo Fighters." So that's what he said, because it actually had a different name. The squadrons called them something you can't really repeat on radar, on radio. But it was shortened for the newspapers to Foo Fighters. And that name stuck because it went around the squadron. By that time, everybody had seen it, this phenomenon. It wasn't just one or two crews. They were all seeing them, different nights, different places, but the same kind of thing that chased after the aircraft. But actually, it wasn't just them, but they just happened to be the squadron that named it. There was another squadron in Belgium. They saw them as well. There were two night fighter squadrons, American ones, that were based in Italy, and they saw them as well. So the name started off in by a unit that was based in France, but it soon spread to the other units as well.
Well, you have great explanations for why the excuse that it was some kind of German technology just wouldn't have applied, given the state that Germany was in, especially toward the end of the war from 43 on, that they couldn't hardly build anything. And they certainly didn't have the kinds of technology that was displayed by these craft, We're going to dive into the documents you brought up and dug up and some of the specific cases. Some great stuff, great stories, kind of bone-chilling at times. We're talking with Graham Rendell about Foo Fighters, UFOs Before Roswell is the name of the book. We're talking with Graham Rendell about his book, UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters, 1940 to 1945. And this book is jam-packed with specific incidents and cases as reported by bomber crews and pilots and personnel on the ground as well. We're going to jump into the heart of it and hear some specifics right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, early in the book, you tell us about these mission reports under the acronym of ORB, O-R-B, which I thought was really playful and fun that it turned out to be that. What is it?
The ORBs are the Operational Records Books for the Royal Air Force, so that's just what they call them. That was a standard sort of mission reporting, if you like, for each squadron.
And right off the bat, in 1940, these British pilots, RAF pilots, and bomber crews are seeing these things. There's a document that you cite from 1940 that has close to 100 of these reports, and clearly there were way more that never made it into any records, right?
Yeah, that's right. The report that you're referring to is dated the 11th of August, 1940, and it's called Phenomenon Connected with Enemy Night Tactics. So already at that time in the war, the RAF were mounting night raids against certain targets in occupied Europe, and it was clear that they were seeing things that they called peculiar incidents, and that's the term that they use in this reporting back then. So this is really early in the war. It's just about the time of the Battle of Britain. And they do see these things, and the number of sort of cases that you quote there, I think it was 92 in total, but the intelligence people sort of dismissed it really because they said, well, only one person in the crew of aircraft is seeing these things and reporting these things. So they did really dismiss these anomalous kind of cases because it was only one person reporting them, which was really strange because some of these aircraft only had two or three crew anyway. It wasn't like the much bigger bombers that you got later in the war where there were five, six, seven, eight, sometimes ten people on board. So, it was very early at least. So the time frame for the Foo Fighters, or at least the phenomenon that happened during World War II, goes back a lot earlier than people sort of can imagine.
Share with me your thoughts on some of the prosaic explanations that might apply. I mean, Germans shining spotlights to distract pilots or dropping flares or other objects that would try to distract them or confuse them, right?
Yeah. So the Germans had a variety of kind of anti-aircraft devices. So not just flak guns, but they had things called decoy rockets, where it was basically a version of a rocket mortar projectile that they use as an artillery round, but they developed it for a surface-to-air decoy rocket which could have parachute flares coming out of it. But it only went up to about 6,000 feet because it had a limited amount of kind of fuel, solid fuel on board. So it never got to the kind of height that the RAF bombers and the American bombers saw these strange things at. And then there were other things. So people, the RAF intelligence, thought that there might be airborne searchlights because the RAF had actually, they'd sort of toyed with these things in about 1941 to try and see whether they could put a searchlight in a twin-engine aircraft and then have a single-engine fighter next to it to try and shoot down bombers that the searchlight picked up in midair. Now, it never worked because every time they switched the searchlight on, it blinded everybody, blinded the pilots. So it didn't work properly. And actually, the Germans never bothered experimenting with airborne searchlights. They had an airborne infrared searchlight, but that's something completely different. It doesn't show up to the human eye. So the kind of things that they were coming up with just didn't really fit the profile. And then, of course, when you went later in the war, they were talking about, well, are they some kind of rocket device? Because the Allies knew that the Germans were experimenting with such things. Obviously, everybody knows about the V2, the missile that hit London and other targets in Europe. But that had a particular profile. It didn't fly around the skies, chasing after aircraft. And then, of course, the Germans also had about 50 different types of missile under development. Some were surface-to-air, some were air-to-surface, some were air-to-air. But none of them ever got as far as being put into real combat, apart from a couple of anti-shipping missiles that got underway and actually got to the front line. So you're looking at kind of things that, yes, in theory, may have been a very, very small part especially when you drill down into, how they were developed and the historical record in terms of, were they tested, were they put into combat, then everything comes up short.
Share with us a couple of examples. Early in the book, you have, they're primarily like rear tail gunners who see these things, and they even shot at them a few times. Bullets go in and have no effect, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the cover of the book that's expertly has been sort of drawn up by my colleagues, Dan Vetterstrom from UAP Media UK, but also from Olaf Rockner in Sweden. It actually depicts an encounter which happened at the end of March 1942. And this was a Polish crewed Wellington bomber that was operating under the RAF. And they were just coming back from a bombing raid on a place called Essen in the Ruhr in Germany, when they were leaving the target area. And this large, luminous, orange-shaped disc object came up behind them. They saw it some distance away. The tail gunner saw it to start with. He reported to the pilot this thing was coming up behind them. And the pilot said, look, if it gets too close, open fire at it, which would be standard practice anyway if it was a night fighter, because that, of course, that's what they thought it would be. Anything that was coming up that was showing lights must be an enemy aircraft. So the gunner did open fire at this thing, and the bullets just went into it, and nothing happened. The object then went round to the wingtip of the aircraft and sat off the wingtip of this Wellington bomber for a while. And again, the tail gunner was firing at it as it was moving round. And then it got to the position where the nose gunner could also open fire as well. But the bullets were having no effect whatsoever. And something that close would have been shot down. But then it moved down to the front of the aircraft and sat and took position some distance off the nose and just sort of sat there as they were flying through the sky. And again, they were opening fire on it and nothing happened. And then it just shot off into the distance. So, there were stories like that throughout the war where gunners were opening fire on things that just didn't, nothing happened to them.
And then you have cases that are cited in the book of where there's multiple objects around the plane and they circle the plane, circle the bomb.
Yes. Yeah, these are the new reports that I managed to find in the course of my research. Some of the reports in the book are already known. Some of them came out in the sort of 2000s and maybe in the 1990s. But there are a whole raft of cases which happened over the Balkans in 1944, so you're looking at Bulgaria, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary. And these were RAF bomber units, which were based in Italy in 1944, which were operating over these areas at night. And in a couple of cases, one particular squadron, which was flying Liberators supplied by the Americans, they were surrounded by red lights over Croatia. And it happened twice over a two-week period, where an aircraft had six red lights either chasing it or surrounding it. Now, that's no kind of German secret weapon that I know of. And certainly that part of Europe was effectively a backwater in terms of the kind of the defenses that the Germans were assigning to that area. They weren't giving their best equipment to places like that, nor were they testing any of their new stuff. So I come up with a kind of as a complete blank as to what this kind of thing could have been, just to give it some kind of prosaic explanation, and I just can't. And nobody I've either contacted to try and work out, what they think it might be. Nobody else can give an answer either. So it's really weird.
One of the cases that you cite direct quotes from it, the object was a glowing orange color. It appeared at 15,000 feet, about 100 to 200 yards away. Its speed was 180 miles per hour, but then it disappeared at an estimated speed of 1,000 miles per hour. We didn't have a plane that went 1,000 miles per hour in 1942,
no,
did we?
No, we didn't. The Germans had a rocket-powered aircraft called the Messerschmitt 163 Comet, but it could only do that under very, very certain conditions in terms of how to be air-launched, and it would have to be to the point of where it was in a steep dive. Now, those aircraft didn't even fly at night, and it was only under test conditions they did that, and only once or twice, and the aircraft nearly crashed. So in terms of, having that kind of thing, a comet could do 1,000 kilometers an hour. Sorry, it couldn't do 1,000 miles an hour. Nothing we had, nothing the Germans had, nothing the Russians had, was supersonic, and that would be 1,000 miles an hour. So, it's difficult to actually put a huge amount of credence on speeds and estimates of speeds, but it clearly flummoxed the bomber pilots and the crews that's how fast these things were moving. And you see a lot of reports throughout the war, and they're quoted in the book, of these very, very fast-moving lights. And sometimes from a standing start and sometimes from very, very slow speeds, as you quoted there.
So the Allied air forces, the Brits and then the Americans later, were pretty much convinced this must be some kind of a German weapon. Maybe they were being dropped from higher flying German planes. Their lights, they would follow along with the planes, the bombers, and then speed off. And despite the preponderance of cases, the hundreds and hundreds of cases there were, if this was a German weapon, it was remarkably ineffective, right? Because to your knowledge, it never really caused any damage.
It didn't cause any damage at all. In fact, the intelligence reports get to the point where they can't understand why nothing's happening. I'll just quote something here. This is from a report from November 1944, and the quote is just two lines. It says, "The phenomenon is seen as a light moving very fast. The general consensus of opinion is no shape can be seen, no aircraft identified, and that objects do not fire. When fired at by the bombers, a large proportion of them burst into flames or explode. No bombers have ever been damaged or, as far as known, even rocked by the explosion of these bodies." So there was it was a weird conundrum as well, because sometimes they were saying that they were actually destroying them. And this is much later in the war. This is towards, you know, the last 6 months of the war. So in Europe, so again, you've got this added dimension. Sometimes they say they destroy them, but again, there's no German secret weapon or any type of weapon that fits these kind of profiles in the terms of the places or the times or the capability. And it's a mystery that we've never been able to solve. Again, that's the same with the UFO mystery right through the ages.
One of the cases I mentioned about the tail gunner shooting at it in that one instance, I imagine that happened a lot. But there's one case where you cite tracer rounds going into firing right into this thing, and they don't come out. So it's not just a spotlight. It's something that just kind of absorbs these rounds.
That's right. That's the case from November 1942. So the tracer rounds were in connection with the bullets. So the tracer rounds were basically so that the gunners could see where they were aiming at. And it was like one tracer bullet out of every 10. It was like an illuminated round. And, of course, they were watching them just going into this disc, and they just disappeared. So whether it was absorbed or something happened, but they didn't come out the other side, and there was no damage that they could see that was inflicted on the disc. And then, of course, you've got other cases from the war where fighter pilots flying at night were actually engaging these lights as well, to the same, you know, lack of effect. So there's a case from North Africa from the spring of 1943 where a Hurricane on a night intruder mission over the desert, he's chased by another light, and he manages to get on its tail, so to speak. There's no shape involved, it's just a light, but he manages to get behind it, and he opens fire with 20mm cannon, and to no effect whatsoever. It just keeps flying. So, you know, nothing the Germans could build would be invulnerable to cannon fire, let alone machine gun fire. So it's just something that can't be explained.
A lot of different names for them through the course of the war. They called them, I think somewhere there was a report that called them the Thing. There was a name, here, let me see if I can find it.
Yeah, they called them the pilots in the RAF, because they came across them first, and they had two names for them. It was either the Thing or the Light. So that they were the names that appeared. And in some pilot logbooks, you'll see dogfight with a Thing or the Light, and that's how they refer to them. The Americans coined, or one particular American unit coined, the name Foo Fighters, but the names changed throughout the war, and also the actual designation of these things changed during the war in the official reporting. So at the first they were called Lights, and then they started calling them Rockets in the mid-war period, and then they started calling them Jets later on. So the actual terminology changed as well as the names that the pilots were calling them.
You know, I can see some of them would act at times like a rocket. I mean, firing off at 1,000 miles per hour, but you can't have a rocket that follows your bomber along for a while at 180 miles an hour, then goes to 1,000, not back in those days anyway, or a rocket that changed positions around the plane. You have a couple of those cases where something is zipping along, and then all of a sudden it's on the other side of the plane and follows along on that side.
That's right, and even the official reporting, so you look at some of the intelligence documents, they mention cases where these so-called rockets zigzagged after aircraft. Now, you know, that technology is way beyond what the Germans could do. They were even having problems with things like propulsion devices and proximity fuses for missiles, let alone managing to control them effectively. So there's no way that the Germans have this kind of technology to be able to do this kind of, you know, maneuvers in flight. they were barely getting these missiles off the ground when they were testing them. So it's really preposterous to try and say that German secret weapons were responsible for the sightings.
At some point later in the war, I guess, the bomber crews would see these things that appeared to be like metal globs or orbs that dropped from the sky, and you could hear them hitting the wings and hitting the craft, but they never caused any damage again.
Yeah, there's a couple of cases from 1943 with the American daylight raids. So there's a raid on Stuttgart, I believe it's September 1943, where what they classed as being a kind of shoal of little black objects came out of the sky and flew through the formation of American bombers. And in one case, actually struck the wings or the tail of another aircraft. There's also another case in Italy in 1944 of a similar kind of shoal of little black or silver objects falling through. And these were entirely really small. I mean, they were classes maybe even 3 inches, like kind of hockey puck sized or size objects. So they weren't very big. But again, it was something that was, just kind of freaked the pilots out and freaked the crews out because they didn't understand what they were seeing. Again, when the analysis was done by the technical departments, they believed it was some kind of German weapon. Now, it might have been something that was developed at a very local level, but there's nothing official ever come out about what those things were. If you ask people who are interested in German weapons and technology, they come up blank when you ask them about things like that.
Were the Germans seeing them as well?
Now, this is the odd thing, because if I had a pound for every time somebody said, the Germans see them, and here's, they say that they thought they were Allied secret weapons, I'd be a rich man. Now, there is anecdotal evidence to suggest that's the case, but finding the documentation to prove that is a different thing. So there are plenty of reports and references in the reports on the Allied side to interrogations with German prisoners to say that they, mentioned these things and they were seeing them. But actually finding those reports is a different thing entirely. Now, that might just be me not being able to find them, but they apparently do exist. And the only thing is that the German records were quite patchy once Germany was finished at the end of the war. They destroyed some of their records. So therefore,
for good reason,
finding things might be difficult. However, in the early part of the war, those records did survive, and the Americans did actually capture quite a lot of material. So it would only take somebody with a fluency in German and an understanding of military technological terms to go through the records at some stage and try and find mention of these things, because they do have daily and morning reports. The Luftwaffe kept meticulous records of things like that, where it was much easier for me to go through the American unit reports and also the RAF unit reports to find things that didn't make sense.
So we've all heard the legend about Nazi super weapons, things that were seized by the Americans and the Russians after the war, and personnel as well. And maybe that was the beginning of our super secret saucer programs that explain all the UFO sightings ever since then. In our next segment, I want to take a deep dive into that. And then sometime in the next hour, we'll open up the phone lines see what's on the minds of our listeners. UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters 40 to 45 by Graham Rendell is my guest tonight, and we'll be back in a moment.